You are listening to the GTT podcast from the Canadian Council of the Blind.
Welcome to the GTT Vancouver online session hosted in Zoom for June 6th, 2020. Welcome to the last GTT Vancouver meeting of this current session. We'll resume again in September. Usually when there's a long weekend at the beginning of the month, we skip to the second Saturday. So thanks to Albert for suggesting this topic and for hosting today's session. I'm the co-host and I'll be talking about passwords, authentication, and everything that goes along with it. There's going to be six subtopics today discussing authentication, security, and passwords. We're going to talk about the origins. We're going to talk about identification and authentication. We're going to talk about multi-factor authentication, two-step verification, password managers, and password viability. One of the most famous references to passwords is Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, the Open Sesame reference to the Magic Cave. A lot of people are aware of that. So that's sort of one of the most popular, relatively contemporary uses of the word password. Came from the 1800s, but they've been with us long before that. One of the earliest references is in the biblical book of Judges, and it concerns the Gileadite soldiers. And what they did is they used the word, and I'm probably going to butcher this. I'm not Google. I don't pronounce things properly necessarily, but the word is shibboleth. And the Gileadite soldiers used the word shibboleth to determine whether people were allies or foes. And if you were a foe, I think you got murdered. So you needed to know how to pronounce that word properly. Term shibboleth is often used to test pronunciation or local jargon. And that's one of the origins of passwords. But they've probably even been around before biblical times. Let's look at a few famous incidents where the shibboleth was used. Unfortunately, a lot of these are sort of negative. They happened in wartime, but I think it's sort of interesting nonetheless. There was the Parsley Massacre in the Dominican Republic in 1937. The Dominican Republicans used a shibboleth of the word, I think, was parsley. I don't know what it was in Spanish. Or Creole. And so they tried to figure out who was Haitian and who was from the Dominican Republic based on the pronunciation of the word parsley. And again, if you didn't pronounce it properly, you were executed. World War II, it was used quite a bit, passwords and shibboleths. The word Lollapalooza was used for the American troops to try to thwart Japanese spies because they had difficulty pronouncing that word. Likewise, in Europe, in World War II, the Allied forces of Great Britain, Canada, America, and some of the other allies used the word thunder to try to determine if people were German or not, because I guess they had difficulty pronouncing that word. So that's kind of how they were used in warfare and in earlier times. Again, more recent times, they're also used to determine custom. So we can take Northern Ireland, for example. There is a city called Derry or Londonderry, depending on where you're from. Again, Catholics say Derry. Londonderry is used by Protestants. So it's a way to determine what side of the fence you're on. There's also an interesting custom in Washington, D.C., so their local airport there. If you are a local who is a Democrat, you will call it a national airport. And if you are a Republican, you'll call it Ronald Reagan Airport. So there's ways to determine it that way as well. A little closer to home in Canada, we too have some shibboleths that we use to authenticate if you are local or not. And there's some examples here that I found quite interesting. We have Newfoundland. So anybody from Canada will probably pronounce it as Newfoundland, kind of a butchered one-word version of Newfoundland, which is what other people tend to call it if you're not from here. Saskatchewan is another one. If you're not from Canada, you may call it Saskatchewan. So that's also an example of a local symbolith. Vancouver is also an example, because apparently people who are not from Vancouver, or perhaps not from Canada, may call it Vancouver, as if it's pronounced V-A-N-G-couver. So that was also a noted example on the internet. And of course, one of the most famous ones, we have Toronto versus Toronto. So those are some good examples of symbolists in Canada. And again, that is very closely linked to passwords and security. Now, if we look at identification and authentication, we're going to take a look and to see exactly what it is. Because if you understand what identification and authentication is, then you have a better chance of succeeding in keeping your information safe. Identification occurs when a person uses something to signify their identity, like a username. Authentication occurs when somebody uses something to verify their identity or prove their identity. Once somebody has supplied their identity and authentication, then the result tends to be that you are granted access to certain information or certain tasks. So that's sort of how identification and authentication works. We're now going to look at multi-factor authentication, and we're going to take a look at how this works. This is a pretty in-depth topic, but I'll try to keep it brief here. So there's three famous factors of authentication. It's easy for some to say. The first factor is something you know, or it's called the knowledge factor. So an example of the first factor, something you know, could be a secret handshake, or it could also be a PIN, or it could be a password. It's the most common factor that most of us are used to using. And I'm going to talk a little bit about passwords here. So we're going to talk about the other famous factors of multi-factor authentication, but we're going to take a quick detour and go into detail about passwords, which again is the most popular of the something you know factor. So the strength of a password is essentially a function of length and complexity and unpredictability. There was a comma in there. So unfortunately, human beings aren't that random. We're not very good at coming up with completely random things. So we tend to use passwords that represent patterns, dates, or keypad adjacent patterns. So like if you're using a phone pad, you might do a 2580 as a four-digit PIN, because we're not very good at randomization. And also repetition is also another flaw that we have with passwords. We tend to use the same one for multiple things. If we look at a four-digit password or a PIN, there's 10,000 combinations. So you might think, wow, that's a lot. Well, it's a lot for a human being to try 10,000 different combinations, but it's not very hard for a computer to use algorithms to figure that out. So it's not very strong. If you want to make a small strength increase on your four-digit password, you might consider to expand the character set. So instead of just numbers and having it be a four-digit numeric PIN, you may adjust it to be an alphanumeric PIN, where you also include letters and symbols in there. That makes it a little bit harder. If you want to make a large increase in strength, you'll make your password longer, because the longer the password, the more difficult it is for people to guess, and it takes a lot longer for computers to go through all of the different calculations. The UK Cyber Security Association has published a list of sort of frequently used passwords, and they got this by looking at data breaches. So when there's a data breach or a hacker gets in and steals a bunch of passwords, they often will publish them online. So the cyber agency looked into this and it determined some of the most common passwords. I'm going to go through those here. I don't know how many they looked at in total, but they found that 23 million of the passwords they looked at was a numeric six-digit password, 123456. So that existed 23 million times, and it's the number one password that people seem to use. I'm not sure if you're one of them. If you are, you might want to change your mind. The second most popular string, again numeric, 1 through 9. And some other really popular ones included the word QWERTY, so QWERTY, which is nice and easy to type. The word password is also very popular, apparently, and the number 1 7 times. I don't know why 7 and not 6 or 8, but 7 ones is also a very, very popular password. Okay, so that was the password detour. We're going to head back into the three famous factors for multi-factor authentication. Number one was something you know or knowledge. Number two is something you have or possession. And some examples of this might be an old-fashioned key that you would use in a door lock, a smartphone, or a token generator, which is a little handheld device that gives you a random number. So that's the second one. The third one, the third factor, is something you are. And something you are has to do with inference. So to explain that a little bit, something you are can be a fingerprint, it can be a retina scan, facial recognition, iris scan, hand geometry, or some attribute about you or your body that makes you unique. It has to do with biometrics. Two additional factors of multi-factor authentication that have been introduced after the famous three were coined. So we have location, and that tends to use phone location based on cell site or mobile mast location, or GPS using the satellites to determine exactly where you are located. The fifth factor is sometimes used as well, and that is time. So that is the way time tends to be used, is in two different ways. If you are being authenticated against time, you may have a time window that you have to enter your password. So let's say you're logging in at work and you work from 9 to 5. So between 5:01 and 8:59 a.m., the computer can know not to let you in because you're out of the time window. The second way, and banks use this quite a lot for credit card fraud and for ATM fraud, is time loosely mixed with location. So if I'm in Port Moody, British Columbia, using my ATM card at 10 in the morning, the authentication system for the bank will know that I also cannot be in Frankfurt, Germany 5 minutes later trying to do the same thing. So it uses time to try to prevent fraud, and that's the fifth factor. Let's look at two-step verification here. It's pretty important. It's sort of one of the buzzwords lately. It's not terribly secure either, but it's a little bit better than using one-factor authentication, which is just a single password. So we're going to look at two-step verification. I'm getting steps and factors mixed up here because they're interchangeable. So it's sometimes called two-factor authentication. It's an improvement on the just asking for a single password because it introduces things like security questions, or it uses something you have to authenticate. And by something you have, it may send a verification code to a cell phone or to an email account. Now, the problem with two-step verification is that it's susceptible to fraud, just like everything else. A couple of the popular methods for two-step verification fraud is SIM jacking, or SIM hijacking, it's sometimes called, or it's also called porting out. And that's where a fraudster contacts your cell phone provider and says that I need to move my account to this new SIM card. And if they're convincing enough through social engineering, then the cell phone provider will say, okay, I will move your account details to your new SIM card. And then that new SIM card that's plugged into their phone with your phone number now receives the information for the second step for verification. And then they get your four-digit code or whatever your service has sent you on your phone, and you enter that in, and boom, they're into your account and can drain all of your money. Of course, email hacking is also a way to make the second step verification susceptible to fraud, and email hacking essentially means, so when you're using two-step verification, sometimes your the provider of the information you're looking to get will send you an email message with a code in it, and all a hacker needs to do is break into your email account and redirect or read that email, and then they can log in as you if they have your password. But like I said, this is still more secure than just your password, so it's worth having. But we'll talk about password strength and viability later on here. Okay, so on to password managers, and this is really what we wanted to talk about today. So what is a password manager? Well, a password is a tool that contains a database of information such as passwords, PINs, credit card information, and essentially things you need to authenticate into a service. So it's a database of all of those things, and essentially it needs a single password to unlock that database so it can be used. So it's, I guess a good way to put this is if, let's say, you have 200 accounts from anything from your television cable provider to your bank to your favorite airline, let's just say you have 200 accounts. Well, 200 passwords is a lot to remember, so instead of that, we put these 200 passwords into a single database, and we give that database a single password. So all you need to do is remember a single password, and then presto, or open sesame, you have access to all of your account passwords and information. If we look at some of the pros to a password manager, you don't need to remember, so that's quite good. You don't need to remember 200 passwords, you just need to remember one. It can generate passwords for you, so it can generate very strong passwords. So again, we talked about multi-character sets, so that they're alphanumeric and include symbols, but we also said that increasing the length also makes it stronger. So these will generate a random password that is quite long, full of different characters that will make any kind of password harder to guess. Another pro is they keep track of all of your passwords. Like we said, you don't need to remember, but it can also keep track of other data that is associated with those passwords. So things like usernames, maybe credit card numbers, ATM numbers, things like that. So you don't need to remember the things that go along with your passwords either. There are some cons, like everything else. Not all browsers or web forms support password managers. All of your eggs are in one basket. And so what I mean by that is if you forget that single password, you may not be able to access your 200 accounts. It's usually belongs in the custody of a third-party company that offers the tool. So if they disappear or go bankrupt or whatever they want to do, then so does your account information and so does your database. It disappears too. One of the other cons, it's a centralized location for thieves to focus on. So if a thief knows that all of your passwords are in a single database, that makes it a little bit easier if they're trying to mount a fraudulent attack. Now, luckily, a lot of these password manager applications have employed various methods of security to try to make it very difficult for thieves to access. If we look specifically at the Apple keychain And we're going to, again, be even more specific and talk about it in terms of iOS devices. It's a password management system that uses a keychain to collect information, such as passwords and user information that can be used across your Apple universe on all of your devices. So they can be used on your various iPhones, iPads, and Mac OS devices, and probably iPod touches as well. It was invented in the early 90s by Apple. Again, it's their product, so you would expect that they invented it. And they used it in a product called PowerTalk, which was one of their first email systems that involved email access and authentication and all this stuff. So that's where the origins of the Apple keychain has come from. They added it to OS 9, OS X or OS 10, and also iOS shortly thereafter, or when they started to come onto the scene. One of the nice things about the Apple keychain is you can use your phone's authentication method to gain access. So that could be your PIN or Apple ID. But what you can also use is a completely separate password that gives you an extra layer. So you're sort of trading security for convenience. It's a little more inconvenient to know another password, but it's a little bit more secure. So the idea behind the password manager is that it stores this information and it will automatically fill out a web form or any sort of other application that is looking for data to authenticate who you are. You should always have a second backup method of storing your passwords in case something goes wrong, as I alluded to above. So if we look at setup, how do you do that on your iOS device? It's pretty simple. You go to settings, Apple ID, iCloud, and keychain, and then you switch it on. It's that easy. If you need to access your password or other information that's stored in your keychain, and I say this because not all web forms and not all applications that collect data from you will elect to receive that information from your keychain. So sometimes you have to paste it in manually. So the keychain also allows you to go and review that information and copy it to the clipboard and then paste it into the application. So if you need to access those passwords, you go to settings, password and accounts, and then websites and app passwords. Now, those names will change depending on your iOS version. Sometimes Apple likes to change the titles in our settings menu, so just be aware of that. But typically, these days, it's in settings, passwords and accounts, and websites and passwords. You may be prompted to use Touch ID or Face ID to log in. So you may have to do that to get in. So it really wants to know it's you before it gives you any of this information. And then you can go down a list of various services you have information stored for. You double tap on that, and then it brings up all of the information that you can just read and memorize, or you can copy it to a clipboard. So like some of the other password managers, you can use it to generate a pseudo-random password. And when I say that, random isn't quite random because computers have to start somewhere. So they tend to have a pattern to their randomness. We're just hoping that fraudsters don't know what that pattern is. But most computers, it's more difficult to have truly randomness because of the way computers process things. But it's pretty random to you and I, and pretty secure. So one of the interesting features that the Apple keychain has is when you are giving it information, such as your credit card information, you don't actually need to type it all in manually. You can take a picture of it with your iPhone's camera, and it will add that information directly to your keychain. So that's pretty cool. So if we look at other password managers that aren't just on iOS and are available for iOS and other platforms, probably the most popular one is called 1Password, and it's free, but you can pay $10 for the pro version. It's available on iOS, Apple Watch, Android, Windows, and Mac OS. LastPass is also a very popular one, pretty accessible. It's available on all the usual platforms, just like I said, for 1Password. PasswordSafe, one of my favorite ones, and that's because it's old, so it's been around for a while. It has a proven track record. It's reliable, it's very accessible, and very importantly to a lot of people is it's open source. So I'll probably tell you a little bit about open source here. That means that the source code that was used to generate the PasswordSafe program is available for anybody to look at and inspect. So if you can inspect what the source code of an application does and you understand what it's exactly doing, then you can determine whether it's doing anything fraudulent. So it's very, very good for people who have the knowledge and expertise to go through it and verify that it is a legitimate product. Being open source, it's also free. I think the author likes donations, but it's free for anybody to download and use. One last thing, Android does not have a keychain in the way that Apple does. They do make keychain style functionality available to various Android apps. And so that's pretty good. They don't all use it, and it's not quite as organized as the Apple keychain. But what a lot of people use on Android devices is the Google Smart Lock application. It's sort of a companion app that Google makes available to Android devices. It may be available on other platforms as well, but you need to use a third-party keychain if you're wanting to use something that's available everywhere on Android. Talk about the death of passwords. And you might be thinking, how do we do that? Like, we need a password to keep our stuff safe. It may not be perfect, but it's better than just using a username. Okay, well, let's look into that a little bit here. So passwords inherently are insecure. As I said earlier, there's dictionary accounts. So that is to say that somebody or something, usually a device, can go through a dictionary and try all the words and combinations of various words to try to crack the password. Cracking algorithms were also developed and used by nefarious people and organized crime groups around the world to try to crack a password. And don't be fooled, an algorithm can figure out a password because it's just trying combinations. Remember I talked about length? Well, length doesn't stop your password from being cracked. It just stops it from being cracked quickly. And as computers get better and faster and can do more at one time, they can go through their list of possibilities quicker too. So a supercomputer can crack a password very, very quickly, making it generally pretty useless. Now, thankfully, not everybody has access to these high-speed computers or the supercomputers, and thankfully, we have other factors of authentication we can use, but it does mean that passwords by themselves aren't terribly secure. Social engineering is also a very popular way to gain access to a password. It's when you speak to a member of customer service or somebody involved with the provider that you're trying to gain information from, and that they essentially convince that person that they are you. And people do that. And again, it makes passwords rather insecure. So how do we get around this? Well, we use biometrics to help us get around this. Again, that's the something you are factor of authentication. And biometrics, like we said before, things like fingerprints, facial ID, retina scans, iris scans, hand geometry, that kind of stuff. And that essentially belongs to you. It's something only you have. Now, it's able to be thwarted as well. Somebody could cut your finger off and use your fingerprint. Maybe there's ways of developing a synthetic fingerprint. I'm sure that's going to happen at some point. And same with retinal scans and iris scans. It's probably very possible to, you know, fraudulently come up with a way around that. But it's much more difficult because we're all very unique in theory. So the people who know predict that passwords by themselves, as we know it today, will not exist 50 years from now.
Now, you mentioned a few of the password managers, and one of the things I wanted to relay to folks, too, is if you go to the Apple Viz gttp.com website, and in their search field, you simply type in password manager. You will come up with a fairly good list of a variety of password managers that AppleVis has in some way, shape, or form evaluated, and will have something to say about their accessibility and usability.
Most of the password managers, or at least the popular ones, seem to have reasonable accessibility. What makes them fall down is they're not accepted everywhere. And like I said, some web forms won't take advantage of password managers. So that's where it may not work. But in terms of accessibility with screen readers, most of the popular ones seem to be quite accessible.
In terms of when you're on a site and you put in your password and stuff, and it always asks, do you want the site to remember you? I always try to say no. And I'm just wondering if that's a good practice. I'm assuming it is. And if so, how can you set the sites to never remember?
So sort of don't remember my passwords or my form information data is a setting that all browsers have. It's in different places depending on the browser, but tends to be under tools and options normally, and oftentimes under security or things like that. It really depends on the browser, and now that there's several browsers we can use, the answer to that is variable. Whether it's a good idea or not, that's kind of up to you.
Yeah.
I bet a lot of people thought it was a good idea for Internet Explorer to save passwords back in the day, and look where we are now with Internet Explorer. That still probably has some people's passwords saved in it. So good idea or not, it just depends on your appetite for risk.
And I just have another question about CAPTCHA. You know how some of these sites, they want you to, even after you've put in all your credit cards and stuff, if you're making a donation, you want them to prove you're not a robot and do a CAPTCHA. I just wonder how valid that is for security. And of course, they're not very accessible most of the time.
They're not perfect, but no. They make it harder. And that's what none of this stuff is perfect. It just makes it harder.
Mm-hmm.
Harder for us for accessibility, and harder for computer algorithms to go through the CAPTCHAs and try to determine what's the relevant information.
I am very concerned about this move my SIM card. I didn't realize that could happen, and that is very scary. Is there any way that I can tell whether my SIM card, and I presume just because it's moved doesn't mean that I still don't have it on my phone and that somebody else also has access to it? There's no way that I can tell whether it's been moved probably, is there?
Well, there is. So first of all, just to sort of explain this a little bit more, think of your SIM card as a very, very small disk that you can write information to, and it plugs into your phone. So you having a physical SIM card, somebody else can also have a physical SIM card, but has essentially a copy of your information on their SIM card. Mm-hmm. So the fact that your SIM card never leaves your phone doesn't mean that it hasn't been cloned or that it hasn't been ported away or SIM hijacked.
Right.
So it could be without your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
One way, There's two ways that typically, two things that typically happen when your SIM card has moved from your provider. Number one, they tend to notify you through a text message or through email. Now, the text message may not go to you because it will go then to the person who hijacked your information.
Right.
But if it goes to your email, presumably it would still go to you. So that's sort of one method that's not foolproof, but it's still one method. I would say one of the easiest ways to figure out if you are still the sole owner of your SIM card is to give yourself a phone call from another phone. And mm-hmm. if your cell phone rings, then you're still in business.
But that doesn't prove that somebody doesn't have a copy of it.
Well, if they have a copy of it and they are using it, then their phone is going to be the phone that rings, not yours.
Okay, great. So it wouldn't ring both phones?
So the way SIM cards and cell providers normally work is the first SIM card that gains access to the network wins.
Okay.
And then it's in use for the duration of while that phone is on. So if they then switched the copy off on their sort of fraudulent phone, and you switched your phone on, then you would have control again.
One of the other sort of security things that the practice we have here in our home, because both of us, my partner and I, we use we use a password manager. But what I've got in my password vault is a few of the critical bits of her information and the password for her password manager. And she has the same about mine, because should one of us, end up in a coma or dead in the ditch, there's an awful lot of accounts. As you said, I think I've got 94 passwords in my password vault from all these accounts all over the place. And so to shut down my life when I'm done, somebody better have access to all these passwords. And so that's how we've opted to do it in our household.
Well, that's why people live forever on Facebook, right? Because people don't know their passwords. So that's a very good idea to not only back up your passwords, but also make sure someone else has access to them if the unfortunate need arises.
And these password managers, did your research show how many of them, or which ones of them have a PC version as well as an iOS version?
Yeah. So most of them cover all the bases. Most of them work on iOS, Mac, Windows, and Android, and quite a few of them work in Linux as well. The open source one, Password Safe, will work anywhere because it can be compiled for any operating system. So it's a very good one. And a lot of them will also now work on the Apple Watch as well. So we have an additional platform to use it on.
So that means that everything will be synchronized from one device to the other. So
in that family of devices. So if you have an Android phone, I don't know exactly what it does when you're using the third-party password manager. Whether it synchronizes to their main account, because they don't all use the internet. Some of them are just, storing it locally. So if that's the case, it may not be shareable across your devices. But certainly, if you're using the Apple Keychain, that will be shared across every device in your Apple family.
So it'll be everything that uses that same Apple ID?
Yes.
So using the Apple Keychain versus using a password vault, your feeling is that you just want that extra layer of security? Because I've just recently just started using the Apple Keychain.
Yeah, so the extra layer of security associated with the Apple Keychain is to use a separate password rather than your sort of login password for your device.
Okay.
So that's an extra step, but like I said, it's trading security for convenience. It's a little more inconvenient to type in another password, but it may be worth it.
And then now, with you saying, with it being open source, the one you were suggesting, you don't have a concern that because it's open source, it's more hackable?
No, because what happens with open source software is that it is available for anybody to read, right? And at the bottom of it, or attached to that file, I'm going to go technical here for a second. I'll try to keep it in English, but there's what's called a checksum. So a checksum goes through that entire file that contains the source code, and it creates a numeric value based on the characters that are inside the file. So a very quick checksum, if you have a word, let's say the word is fun. So that's F, which is the sixth letter, U, which is the 21st letter, and N, which is the 14th letter. So that is 41. So the checksum might be 41. So if the checksum matches the information in the text file, then you know that nothing has changed. And when nothing has changed, and you're able to understand what's inside that source code, if you are a programmer, then you can be assured that nobody has tampered with it.
You mentioned that it would be 50 years or so before they could do the biological retina scans and fingerprints. Well, why not tomorrow? I mean, you got the thing on the iPhone already.
So it wasn't that it was going to take 50 years for the biometrics to happen. It's going to take 50 years for us to get rid of the notion of having a password. And that's because retina scans and things like that they're not everywhere. So for example, if you think of some of your banks, some of them are better than others, but they tend to all still use passwords and passcodes. And so what I was saying is, in order, before all of the passwords sort of die out over time as people advance, it's going to take up to 50 years for them to go away. But you know, technology moves quickly. So maybe if there's a cheap and fast and easy way, or maybe if there's an exploit that takes place that just makes everything totally insecure, then we'll move pretty quickly, right? Like, look at how fast we can move when we need to. This has been an interesting topic because it sort of opens up a huge can of worms when you start digging and you see how insecure passwords and security really can be.
I mean, that just, what you just said a minute ago, mean bigger incentive to go to the biotechnical to my mind.
It absolutely is. It's just right now it's expensive. It's the sixth factor, expense. So, and convenience. That's what it all boils down to. So if a bank had to send you a device that had some kind of camera on it and could process your biometric information, I mean, a smartphone can do that. But a bank isn't going to want to give every customer a smartphone so that it can do that. It's too expensive. So they always have to sort of weigh convenience with security. And so far, a lot of services lean towards convenience over security, because if a service is too difficult to access, then people tend to choose another service.
I know I've come to love the Face ID on my iPhone 10. I use it to unlock my bank app. I use it for my password manager. I have to type in my 6-digit code to first open it. But as long as I leave it in the app switcher, all I need, if I'm going to use it any time later in the day, I just need Face ID to open it up, to unlock it.
Can I ask a quick question, Albert, about Face ID? Because I still have one of the old iPhones that uses Touch ID. If, for example, the world has a pandemic and you grow a beard and you didn't have one before, does it still know who you are, or does it get confused?
Apparently, it still works. I mean, I can put on sunglasses and it still recognizes it. I can put these headphones on that I've got on right now and it still recognizes me.
Going off your nose or something else.
It takes a contour of, you know, all sections of your face. So some people are saying that they're even working on these Face ID apps or programs or features for the wearing of masks that people are doing now. And so just seeing the area around your eyes is enough for it to recognize your face. So it's working very well. I think Tom Decker has indicated that it works just fine, you know, now that he has this great, huge, long beard.
ZZ Top beard.
Yeah, his ZZ Top beard. So it does seem to work very well. I certainly have preferred it over the old fingerprint, because the fingerprint didn't work if your finger was wet or if it was cold. You'd just come in from outside. But the Face ID doesn't seem to have those limitations.
I have an artificial eye, and I was very concerned about using Face ID. Somebody told me that if I had an artificial eye, Face ID wouldn't work. So, Albert, you're saying you wear sunglasses and it works. So that would lead me to believe that the Face ID would not be an issue.
Well, there is one issue that those of us who are blind have to turn off in the Face ID feature, and that is the gaze. It has something to do with gaze. In other words, even if I'm not looking right at the screen, it still recognizes my face. So it's slightly less secure than if you have to stare, you know, at a certain point on the screen. So for those of us who are blind or use artificial eyes and that sort of thing, they recommend turning off the requirement to gaze at the
phone. Yeah, what it'll do, Robert, is it will, essentially what it does is it divides your face into a grid. So with each cell having a score attached to it. So what it would probably do is say, well, I have 12 squares in this grid and 11 of them have a very high score saying that you are who I think you are. One has a very low score, but 11 out of 12 is pretty good. So you probably are who you say you are, and I'll let you in.
Yeah, just commenting on the you turning the thing off to do with your eyes being blind. I also found partially sighted. It wasn't until Brody got me to turn that element off, because I tend to squint. According to the photo, I guess my eyes weren't open enough. So I ended up having to turn it off But I've recently just set up two-factor authentication on all of my iDevices, and I'm finding the touch is working really well, sometimes almost faster than the facial ID. And I've just recently updated all of my devices to the newest iOS version, so I don't know if that's the reason why, but that's just a comment on that.
Yeah, I think everybody's going to find something that works best for them, but it's good to hear that that works well for you. I have one other thing to share when we sort of kick off the second part of today's session. I don't know if people want me to go first since I'm already on. If you don't mind, maybe I will. So it has to do with how I'm presenting today. And some of you may be familiar with this concept and some of you may use this system. But I'm using my iPhone with a QWERTY keyboard, with my Blue Yeti microphone, and with my iPhone, of course. And I also have my iPhone plugged into my Ethernet, so I'm not using a wireless connection. And you may be thinking, what kind of iPhone is that that has all these connectivity options? And it's not the iPhone itself, but it is. I got myself a Lightning to USB 3 camera adapter from Apple. They're $49, and essentially what it is it plugs into your Lightning port, and it gives you two ports on the other end, a USB 3 USB socket, and also another Lightning socket. So into that USB socket, I've plugged in a USB hub that gives me four USB sockets, and I can just plug different devices in, and it works great.
It's certainly very, like you're crystal clear. You're also, your Wi-Fi isn't waving in and out. You know,
because there isn't Wi-Fi. It's directly wired into my network.
Exactly. That's
so it's pretty cool. And you can use a QWERTY keyboard to use VoiceOver as well. And I don't know, like I'm probably not the first one to do this and what have you, but I find that it's a very welcome change when I'm doing something like this. Hmm. So for $49, you can get this Lightning to USB adapter, and it gives you the ability to plug lots of different things into your iPhone. You can even plug in USB sticks, memory drives, things like that. It's pretty cool. Yeah, so it's called if anybody's looking at the Apple Store, it's called a Lightning to USB camera adapter. It's actually USB 3. I think there's an older one that's USB 2.
And so Monty, with your setup, what about the power? Are you plugged in or what?
Powered USB hub. So I can plug, I'm actually using one of my Google Home Mini adapters to power my USB hub at the moment. So it gives a bit of power to the devices that your iPhone is using. Because the iPhone itself only puts out 100 milliamps of power. So that was enough to power my Blue Yeti microphone by itself, but it wasn't enough power to run everything else.
Would you explain a bit more about how you get connected into your Ethernet network? You mentioned a USB hub. Is that what's actually plugged into the Ethernet network, and then you plug your phone through the connector? I'm not quite clear how this works.
I get your question. So what it is the hub is separate from the Ethernet adapter. So the Ethernet adapter is what's called a USB to Ethernet adapter. So you can plug it into a USB hub or a computer, and essentially it converts a USB port into a regular RJ45 Ethernet port, and you can plug an Ethernet cable into that directly. So I have the adapter plugged into the USB hub plugged into the USB to Lightning adapter, and the USB to Lightning adapter plugged into my iPhone.
Could you be plugging that the USB to Ethernet adapter into the Lightning USB 3 camera adapter, or like, do you have to go through a hub?
Nope. The only reason I'm going through a hub is because I have about four devices hooked up to my phone right now.
Right. Okay. Because I didn't realize that we could run an iPhone or an iPad over the Ethernet network. That would sure solve, for Zoom, that would solve a lot of Wi-Fi related issues.
Yeah, they don't advertise that fact, even with the device itself. It's only purported to work with a camera adapter. Mm-hmm. Well, it's sold as a camera adapter. I think the idea was so that you could transfer images to or from your camera, but it will also work on a host of other devices. So as long as your iPhone operating system can support it, and it happens to support my USB to Ethernet adapter. I think it's a Belkin. It's possible that it won't support everything, but it supported most everything I've thrown at it so far.
Thank you for listening to the GTT podcast from the Canadian Council of the Blind. There are many ways to get in touch with us. You can call us toll-free at 1-877-304-0968. You can follow our GTT blog at gttprogram.blog. If you'd like to subscribe to our email support list, you can send a blank email to gttsupport+subscribe@groups.io. And you can follow the Canadian Council of the Blind on the web at ccbnational.net.